Good evening. Good evening. My name is Bryn McNamee-Tweed, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Department of American Studies and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank you for coming to tonight's program, Is Choice a Human Right? Reproductive Justice in the U.S. As the National Coordinator of Sister Song Women's Reproductive Health Collective, Loretta Ross is committed to achieving reproductive justice for all women. The organization began in 1997 as a grassroots coalition and has grown into one of the preeminent reproductive health organizations in the U.S. Today, the organization is working to shift the focus of reproductive justice to the reproductive oppression women encounter, specifically the exploitation of women and girls through their bodies, sexuality, labor, and reproduction. Sister Song's mission is to strengthen and amplify the collective voices of indigenous women and women of color so that they may secure their human rights and thus achieve reproductive justice. Loretta Ross was the national co-director of the 2004 March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C., the largest protest march in U.S. history, with more than 1 million participants. Between 1996 and 2004, she was the founder and executive director of the National Center for Human Rights Education in Atlanta, Georgia. Ms. Ross has appeared as a political commentator on Good Morning America and CNN, and she has written several publications, including a co-authored book titled Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organized for Reproductive Justice. At this time, I would like to remind the audience to turn off all cell phones and electronic devices. Out of courtesy to our hearing-impaired audience members, and because this program will be taped, I ask that you wait until the microphone reaches you before you speak during the question and answer session to follow. And now, please join me in welcoming Ms. Loretta Ross.
Good evening. Can y'all hear me? I have one of those stentorian voices. I inherited from my father. My father was Elvis's drill sergeant. One of the things you don't know about me, if I'm ever a Jeopardy question, you can pull that fact out. First of all, thank you. This is, I believe, my second time ever at Dickinson College. The first time probably was about a decade ago that I was here, and so it's great to be back to see a whole new crop of faces and some ones that I've met in the past, and it's really cool to be here. Hi, over there. An overflow audience, that's quite impressive. All right. So y'all really have turned out quite a number of people here, and so I'm very, very much impressed. I bought some Sister Song newsletters that are out in the back, and so if someone could make sure that they got bought in and distributed to the audience, because I'd really hate to take those back home. And because we're a poor nonprofit, I can't afford to throw them away and pretend I passed them out. So please, you heard in the introduction about Sister Song, we like to think that we're the most exciting thing happening within what's known as the pro-choice movement. We started out, as you heard, in 1997, of 16 women of color organizations. And it was kind of mechanical because there was 4 black, 4 Native American, 4 Asian Pacific Islander, 4 Latinas. And we decided that we would form a coalition, largely because we were all doing reproductive health work in our communities, but we didn't think that we were getting any respect. Because when you start talking about reproductive health issues in communities of color, people kind of cringe and wish you didn't go there. And then at the same time, because we were approaching the work differently from the way the mainstream was approaching it, with almost an exclusive focus on abortion, they cringed too. And so we thought by pulling together a collective, like our motto said, we could do collectively what we couldn't do individually. So it's very exciting to found Sister Song and to recognize this was the 5th time women of color had tried to organize a national coalition. And most of them fell apart after only a couple of years. And so the fact that we've lasted 12 years, we're very proud of that. But we're also proud of the fact that we offered a radical analysis called reproductive justice using the human rights framework that I'm going to talk about mainly in my speech, But this radical analysis became so popular that all of a sudden, more than just women of color wanted to join Sister Song. And so in 2003, we opened up our ranks so that white women could join Sister Song, so that men could join Sister Song, so that just about anybody who cared about the conditions and communities of color could join Sister Song. And then that kind of changed things. So now we're up to 80 groups instead of the original 16 that we started with. And we're probably the most successful, and I'm not just bragging, though it is my job to brag. They pay me quite well to brag. But I guess I should say the reason I'm using the word successful is because not everybody in Sister Song is pro-choice. There is a pro-life wing of Sister Song that's been there from the beginning. And so we think of ourselves as the most successful model for how people who differ on abortion can find a way to work together. And that's pretty unusual in our society. And so we're quite proud of that. And we'll talk more about that in the Q&A if you want to. So we've passed out our newsletter. On the front of our newsletter is a picture of our office building called the Mother House. We're very proud because we bought that building a couple of years ago. And so we have a headquarters for feminists of color organizing in the United States. And we feel very, very proud of that. And I want to encourage all of you to get online and become members of Sister Song. We have a sliding scale down to $10. You have to be a member to apply for scholarships and stuff like that to attend our conferences. Our next big conference, we have an annual meeting that's going to be in November of this year in Washington, D.C., that will be looking at public policy. And we have a lobby day attached to that. But while that's going to be wonderful and fun with the Obama administration and all of that, our favorite conference that we're organizing is in 2010. In 2007, we had a conference called Let's Talk About Sex. Complete with the song, Let's Talk About Sex, Baby. Well, in 2010, we're doing another conference, and this one's called Let's Talk About Sex Some More. And it's going to be on Miami Beach. Yeah, talking about sex on the beach, how appropriate. And we brought together over 1,000 women of color and allies to talk, to have frank conversations about sex. Because how can you talk about keeping yourself healthy if you can't talk about sex? And we found that so much sexual prohibition is taking place in our society that the human right of young people to sex and sexuality doesn't even get discussed. And so we said, well, we could do something about that. We had a whole conference on it. And we have a special scholarship for our conferences that we call our mother-daughter scholarships, which basically works like this. If the mother or the daughter is registered for the conference, then they can apply for a scholarship to bring the other so that the conversations about sex are intra-family, not just between strangers. And we use that shorthand mother-daughter, but it can either be, you know, daughter-father, uncle, daughter, it doesn't matter, uncle, niece, I guess. It's just the nomenclature, it's the name for bringing a family member with you to talk about sex in a healthy way. That's what it means for us. And so you have to be a member, though, to apply for any of our scholarships. So enough of my commercial on Sister Song. I was asked tonight to talk about reproductive justice and human rights. I understand that y'all have had a number of speakers here so far talking about human rights, and you even had one of my dear friends, Aisha Simmons, here with her No documentary, and Aisha was kind enough to put me in that film that's made the rounds. And so it's amazing to become quite notorious and not even have anything really to do with it, but that's because Aisha's doing a great job. But to tell you the story of reproductive justice, I do need to delve a little bit more into the background of Sister Song, the organization. When we were first founded in 1997,
we knew that we shared with the pro-choice movement a commitment to ensuring that every woman had the right not to have a child. And that's through birth control, through abortion. Hey, we even supported her using abstinence if she could hold on. I mean, I've heard it can be done. I can't attest to it, but I've heard it can be done. Okay? But because we come from communities of color whose right to have children is deeply contested by the society in strategies we can only call population control strategies, we have to fight equally hard for the right to have kids. Yeah, most of us, by the way, when we heard about Nadia Silliman, the Octomom, the first thing many of us said is, thank God she's not black. Because we know what kind of racist rants would have erupted if a black woman in America dared to publicly have 14 babies. I mean, we've got welfare caps that don't want us to have two, you know, much less more. And so we have to fight for the right to have children and to have them under the conditions under which we want to have them, like the right to use midwives and not go to jail for it, or the right to nurse our babies, and all the different things that are being abrogated in our society. The last thing you want to be is, for example, an incarcerated woman, either for being an undocumented immigrant or actually someone convicted of a crime, and try to exercise your mothering rights. It just doesn't happen very well in our society. And then the third thing is that we have to fight for the right to parent the children that we have, because even our right to be parents is deeply contested. Our children get tracked out of schools into jails, often without a call to mom. I mean, it's just that quickly. Matter of fact, if you look at the construction of schools in most communities of color, they look like pre-prisons, like they're training people to exist in sterile boxes with no lights, no windows, no amenities, and getting them ready. And so we started out saying we have to fight for the right to have, to not have, and to parent children. And the have and to parent children pretty much separated us from the pro-choice movement that almost exclusively focused on abortion rights. Not always, but that was their dominant focus. And so we've always problematized the choice framework. Not because it's not a good framework, by the way. We think choices are wonderful things to have. It's what we work towards. The problem is, coming from where we are coming from, we have to recognize that vulnerable communities lack choices. Lack choices. And so you can't use a one-size-fits-all framework for a community that's deeply under surveillance, that lacks basic health care access, that can't decide whether or not to have a child for fear of an immigration raid. I mean, you just can't separate those kinds of things. So we've always thought the choice framework was a little inadequate for describing our reality. But for those of you who want to wax a little more legalistic on it, even if you aren't from a community of color, the choice framework and the privacy argument that sustains it is standing on some very shaky ground. Not only is it vulnerable, to, like Roe v. Wade is vulnerable to being overturned by one mere change of a Supreme Court justice. I mean, that's why we're all worried about Justice Ginsburg's health right now, because, you know, we got, maybe Obama may get a chance to replace her with another liberal, but that still leaves a one-vote majority. And unfortunately, our opponents are the younger ones on the Supreme Court. So it rests upon the slimmest of legal threads at the Supreme Court level already. But to be honest, it rests upon a fundamental argument that is shaky. In deciding Roe v. Wade, They rested it on the concept of privacy, which had been decided, of course, in Doe v. Bolton and another decision around the right of a married couple to use birth control, giving right to the concept of privacy, a constitutional right to privacy, that heretofore had not existed. Because the Constitution and the Bill of Rights talk about, you know, what is it, peace, what is it, happiness? God, I forgot my civics lesson. What does the Bill of Rights say? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Doesn't say anything about privacy. And so the Supreme Court conceptualized the concept of privacy, first around a birth control decision and then extended it to an abortion decision. Except what the Supreme Court giveth, the Supreme Court can take it away. Because there is no written right to privacy in the Constitution. Not only that, but in deciding Roe, I'm totally convinced that only a group of men would say in the first trimester or the first 3 months, the woman decides, because the state has very little interest in that pregnancy. And in the second 3 months, the second trimester, we've got to balance the state and the individual interest. But in the third trimester, the last 3 months, that's when the state has the most interest in the outcome of that pregnancy. And I swear, only men could think of a woman as one-third pregnant, two-thirds pregnant, or three-thirds pregnant. That does not make any sense. I hate to tell you this, boys, but it's all or nothing. Either you are pregnant or you're not. You know, it doesn't quite work that way. And so, we always thought that Roe in and of itself was a very shaky decision. Not that we didn't welcome it like the rest of the women's movement, but it rests on some very shaky ground. As a matter of fact, we should have done what Canada did. When Canada decided to decriminalize abortion, it looked as our mistake and did better. What they did was decide that to deny women the right to abortion denied a medical service to a class of people called women, and that formed sex discrimination, because only one set of people called women would experience that denial. And so to amend that situation, they changed the Canadian Constitution, specifically and explicitly saying that denial of abortion is a form of sex discrimination not allowed under the Canadian Constitution. To me, that is a much more secure basis to claim that body of right than we did. And I can't believe we all were sneering at other countries when they do things so much better than we in some instances. And this is a classic example. Subsequently, you do not see the virulent, violent anti-abortion movement north of the border that you see down here. Because they know they'd have to amend the entire Canadian Constitution as opposed to just simply replace one justice on the Supreme Court. It's a different prospect, a different battle. So, having said all of that, that's what's wrong with choice, by the way. We sought something differently. And something different, if I learn English correctly. One thing that influenced our thinking was that during the United Nations Decade for Women and other United Nations conferences, some of us had an opportunity to travel overseas and participate in the global women's movement. And one really important conference occurred in 1994, the International Conference on Population and Development that took place in Cairo, Egypt. A number of us who went on to found Sister Song had gone to the ICPD. And one thing that was significant as an outcome of the ICPD was that it definitively proved to the world that it is impossible to address the population problem without addressing the poverty problem. There's a link between population and development, or underdevelopment, to be more accurate. And that women who do not believe that they have educational, economic opportunities, and the freedom to control their own bodies are not going to make the reproductive decisions we probably wish they did. I don't know, let me say that a little bit better. The way American women reduced our family size was by having job and educational opportunities. That, hard as it may sound for the rest of the world to believe, is the only thing that works with women all over the world. There's no magic to this. When you give women educational and economic opportunities, they will do everything in their power to control their reproduction so they can take advantage of those opportunities. If you fail to give educational and economic opportunities, you could put a birth control clinic in a teenager's bedroom and she will still get pregnant. Because she doesn't believe she has any educational or economic opportunities. Becoming a mother is her future. That she's going to logically choose. Now, we may grimace and talk about it, but the point is, she may be making a logical decision from her point of view. And so, we came home from Egypt, aware that internationally, people use the human rights framework to claim these rights. And they talked about freedom from poverty as a human right, and the right to determine the spacing of your children as a human right. I mean, they were using all of this language that was wonderful, but we came home asking ourselves the question, well, why aren't we talking about that here? Why do we keep talking about the U.S. Constitution, which is silent on everything we care about, and the rest of the global women's movement is using the human rights framework? And then we were bolstered when next year at the Beijing World Conference for Women in 1995, Hillary Clinton got on the world stage and proclaimed that women's rights are human rights. And we're like, okay, this is good. We're getting somewhere. And so, in 1994, the other thing that was happening was that Hillary Clinton was in charge of the Clinton administration's campaign to reform health care. Y'all remember that. One of the things that disturbed us as women of color was that in an effort to thwart the opposition to health care reform, the administration had quickly decided that they were not going to mention anything about abortion rights in health care reform. Now, it's a shame they didn't ask us, because one thing that we've learned over the years is that it's probably not a good idea to sell out your friends in order to win over your enemies, because the enemies still don't like you, and then your friends are still pissed. And that's exactly the dilemma that they found themselves in. And so a group of us African-American women were at this Illinois Pro-Choice Conference in 1994, and we decided to purchase a full-page ad in the Washington Post, protesting the omission of abortion rights from health care reform. Because for many women, reproductive health care is our main reason for intersecting with the health care system. So if you're silent on reproductive health care, you're basically saying you don't matter. At least that's the signal we got. And so on August 16th, 1994, we purchased this ad by black women. And it was a really cute campaign. We did it in 3 weeks. We raised like $40,000 in 3 weeks. We didn't think we could do that. But we obviously struck a rock and dislodged a boulder when we said this is something we need to do. We didn't know what to call ourselves, though, when we were organizing this campaign, because many of us worked in many different organizations. We were like a caucus at a pro-choice conference. You may not remember these days, but quite often the only way women of color could get together was to go to the white events and then caucus in somebody's hotel room. That was what we did. And every time we did that, the white women were so convinced we were talking about them. It was about them. It was about our opportunity to build our own movement. Yeah, I think many of them wish they could have been like eavesdropping on those conversations to make sure they weren't the subject of them. Anyway, we didn't know what to call ourselves. And so we wanted to be inclusive because we didn't want to just say African-American women, because we wanted to acknowledge that there were women from Africa in the mix, black women from Latin America in the mix, etc. So we called ourselves Women of African Descent. And I'm really glad that name didn't stick, because we would have been called the Wadis. Not good thinking. But Women of African Descent for Reproductive Justice became the full title that was in that signature ad in the Washington Post. And we conceptualized reproductive justice as a way to look at our reality using the things I talked about before, the right to have, not to have, and to parent our kids. Think about it. Every time a woman is pregnant, let me back that up. Every time a woman misses a period, she doesn't even actually have to be pregnant, all of a sudden, she's got all these, oh my God, conversations going on in her head. Oh my God, oh my God. Anybody ever have an oh my God conversation? Yeah. You know? It's like, comes with the territory, you know? If you've ever been late, you've been there, even if you don't want to admit it. And, I mean, isn't that true? Y'all are laughing, but this is true. Boys, you just don't get it. Oh my God happens after someone tells you. This is the oh my God before you even get told. And what's going on in your head at the time is, oh my God, am I going to be able to stay in school? Oh my God, do I even have health care? Oh my God, what am I going to tell my boss? What am I going to tell my mom? I mean, what am I going to, you know, all of this is going on in your head long before you ever get to the decision of whether you're going to have or not have that child. As a matter of fact, the answers to the oh my God questions determine what you're going to do with the have or not have questions. If you don't have health care or a bedroom to put this child in or a job, or you're afraid you're going to get beaten or deported or whatever, the answer to those questions determine the other. And so the critique that we offer is that both the pro-choice and the pro-life movement historically only look at the end game, whether to have or not have the child. But if you want to keep the whole woman in the picture, you got to start with the oh my God moments. Because those are the ones that determine whether someone decides to parent or not. Does that make sense to people? And there's nothing worse than someone having to choose an abortion who would rather have become a parent, but because there was no answer to the oh my God questions. And so, when we conceptualized reproductive justice, we talked about all of those oh my God questions can be seen as human rights issues. The right to a job, health care, things like that. Or social justice issues in U.S. parlance. And then we've got all of these reproductive rights out here. And so we smushed reproductive rights together with social justice, and we coined the term reproductive justice to talk about the ending of the isolation of abortion from all the other, oh my God, social justice issues that really affect abortion. Does that make sense to people? Okay. That was his original iteration. In 1994, we did the ad, then we found his sister song in 1997, using reproductive justice as a central organizing frame. And then, of course, infusing it with the human rights framework. I'm going to come back and tell y'all more about the human rights framework, because Stephanie does not want me to get out of here with doing that without doing that, because that's what she experienced at Trinity. She wants to hear more of that. Right, Stephanie? Okay. But in its present evolution, reproductive justice is actually emerging as a new iteration of critical race theory that's looking at the application of intersectionality to reproductive politics. So for those of you women's studies folks in the house, I just, you know, gave you a quick, I'm sorry, I'm majoring in, I'm getting a PhD in women's studies at Emory, and so I'm being Foucault to death. Whole nother conversation. I'm fascinated by how the theory of feminist theory is so divorced from the feminist movement, but that's a different speech. Let's come back to human rights. If we talk about reproductive justice being based on the human rights framework, then we kind of have to know what that framework is. And I know y'all have had previous human rights lectures this semester, and last semester, I believe. But I do want to do a quick pop quiz on you. By a show of hands, how many of you heard the phrase human rights? Get those hands up there. I know most of you have. Okay. By that same show of hands, how many of you can name the 8 categories of human rights protection to which we're all entitled? Stephanie, you're cheating. She was in my last lecture. Okay, yours was the only hand that went up. There's a small problem we have, folks, and that is you can't fight for rights you don't know you have. I think if we asked every one of us in this room, we'd all come up with our own individual, different definition of human rights, because we've never actually received formal human rights education to know what these things are. I mean, when somebody says human rights to us, we think of the tortured prisoner in a jail overseas somewhere that we have to write letters to help, which is a form of human rights. But in order to make claims for our human rights, we kind of have to know what they are and where they come from. So if you'll indulge me for a while, I'm going to do a quick and dirty human rights education lecture for you. Because I never want an audience to leave here of mine to leave without knowing what their rights are. The modern concept of human rights is based on rather recent events, but it would be incorrect to say that human rights began recently, because human rights are merely the rules by which that people write that determine how they treat each other. So the concept of human rights goes back as far as the Code of Hammurabi, the Torah, the Bible, Confucius. I mean, all of these people had rules for how people should treat each other. The first time I've seen the phrase human rights used in an American context, Frederick Douglass used the phrase in 1858 to protest the lynching of a black man in New York City. So human rights has a long history that I'm not going to get into right now. But the modern version, what we know as the current human rights regime, was born out of the Holocaust. And that was because during World War II, when the world community finally acknowledged the reality of the Holocaust that Nazi Germany had perpetrated, they had killed 6 million Jews and gypsies and homosexuals and people who were physically or mentally disabled and anybody else they didn't like. And what the world community recognized rather belatedly was, while what Nazi Germany did was immoral, it was not illegal. You understand the distinction? There was not a body of law that existed that prohibited what Nazi Germany did to its own people. It was illegal for Germany to invade another country, like Poland. But the concept of sovereignty protected it from criticism for what happened within its own country. And this was something we took advantage of, too, as a country. We legitimated slavery. Immoral, but not illegal. Countries have a really bad habit of legitimating bad things they want to do. They make them legal. But that doesn't make them less horrific. That just means you won't go to jail for it. Oh, I wish we could talk about torture in Guantanamo, but that's a whole other question. Anyway, what the world community wanted to do was to write a body of law that would say, regardless of concerns of sovereignty, the world community will no longer let these type of atrocities take place within a country hiding behind the banner of sovereignty. And it's important to note that not only was the word genocide created during the genocide and didn't exist before 1943, when a Jewish lawyer named Raphael Lemkin wrote the word and coined it for the deliberate erasure of human beings from the earth. But it's important to note that the whole genocidal practices of Nazi Germany did not begin with the ovens and the gas chambers. It began with policies of social exclusion, discrimination, forbidding Jews to go to schools, to work in their jobs, to move out of their neighborhoods, which is why the term ghetto was created to describe the confinement of Jews thousands of years ago. Okay? To not allow people to have health care. These were the policies that formed the pattern of genocide. So, the world community basically said that this is unacceptable. And so, when the United Nations was founded in 1945, it deputized former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt to chair a committee that would write a body of law that would prohibit genocide and atrocities by governments against their own people. And from that committee came the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It took them 2 years, from 1946 to 1948, but on December 10th, 1948, the UDHR, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, was presented to the United Nations for affirmation, and that's why December 10th is Human Rights Day forever, you know, when you celebrate it. And in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, they laid out five categories of human rights protections to which we are entitled. And keep in mind, as I talk about these categories, the whole concept of human rights is born out of articulating what is your relationship to your government. It can be used to criticize other governments, but that's not its original intent. Its original intent was to talk about what can your government do to you and what should be forbidden for your government to do to you. What should it do and what can it do? Can't it do, I guess that's one way to put it. So they laid out five categories, and I'm going to go through those fairly quickly. The first category is called civil rights, and that's the right to be treated as an equal in society, non-discrimination rights. Y'all are familiar with civil rights, right? Had a whole civil rights movement. Kind of have to be dead or asleep or a Republican not to know. Sorry. I might have pissed off some Republicans in the room. I just think it's so amusing when a let me not go there. I'll make sure. I'm sorry. I can't help it. Let me move on. The problem with equality, and you say, well, what could be wrong with equality? That sounds like a good thing. Is that under our constitutional system, it is perfectly possible to treat things equally without delivering justice. Because all you have to commit to is to treat two things equally badly and not discriminate. For example, I don't know you, but I've got a job at my office and I'm going to pay you $15 an hour for it. Is that okay? Not much, but it'll do. In Atlanta, that's a good salary. Okay, in my office, I got the same job, but I'm going to pay you $5 an hour. You know, my boyfriend pissed me off last night, so you're a guy, you're getting $15 an hour, $5 an hour. What's clear is that I've got two people working the same job, and I'm paying her $15 and him $5. I'm clearly discriminating. There's a number of ways to address this situation, and it's urgent that I address it because he can take me to any court in America, particularly with the Lilly Ledbetter Pay Act that just got passed, and charge me with discrimination. So, anticipating this, what do most employers do? Do they raise him to $15 an hour, or do they drop her to $5? Somebody just lost $10 an hour. I have achieved a status of non-discrimination. I have satisfied the civil rights law. There's only one problem. What do you think that problem is? The job should be paying $15. So you can achieve equality without justice. Does that make sense to people? This is something that the African American civil rights movement recognized some time ago in the 1950s when it chose to only fight for civil rights and not the full spectrum of human rights. That's a whole nother speech and a whole nother question, but in hindsight, we know it was a big mistake because every march after the fall of Jim Crow was about jobs and justice. Dr. King was killed marching for jobs and justice, understanding that civil rights were woefully incomplete. One of the concerns I have is that new social movements are emerging that use the civil rights movement as its template. And so you've got the LGBT movement, the queer rights movement, demanding civil rights, which may or may not deliver justice. So that's a whole other question. The second category of human rights is called political human rights. How much time do I have? I noticed you looked at your watch. So, how much time do I have, y'all?
All night.
I wished. Honey, if I keep you all night, it's going to be called sexual harassment. I ain't going to let her talk all night. Don't anybody take me seriously around that kind of stuff. God, y'all are uptight. Don't come to our Let's Talk About Sex conference. Y'all ain't loose enough. Anyway. Political human rights. Those are the human rights that we're mostly familiar with because they're the only set of human rights that we teach a little bit about when we teach the Bill of Rights in our civics classes. So freedom of speech is a political human right. Freedom of association is a political human right. Freedom to vote is a human right. But we don't have the rights to have our votes counted. So we ain't quite there yet. If y'all noticed in the last couple of elections, well, the ones before this one. So political human rights are very important. The third category is called economic human rights, and they're being talked about quite a lot nowadays, only not necessarily in that, using that phrase, because our economic human rights are our right to have the economy managed in such a way that it meets our needs. What a novel idea that is, that Wall Street obviously doesn't get. Because heretofore, we've only had the economy managed in such a way that it met the needs of Wall Street. Does AIG come to mind? And the fact that we can't get student loans, auto loans, mortgage loans, any kind of anything. Those of us with perfectly good 700 plus credit, getting our credit slashed down. I got so pissed at a bank, I almost went postal on them yesterday. I got a check from a real estate broker. And because I thought this broker was a little shaky, I took it to his bank to cash it, Citibank. They charged me $5 to cash a check written on their own damn bank. I'm like, what's the difference between you and a check cashing place up the street? At least if they're not the bank the check's written on. I mean, how unjust is this? That you're getting billions of dollars of my tax dollars as a bailout, and now you're charging me to cash a check written on your bank just because I don't have an account here. I mean, they are screwing us without a kiss in so many ways. For an hour, I flirted with doing a Timothy McVeigh on the bank. I was just so mad. And this populist rage is something that Obama would ignore at his own risk, because I'm a strong supporter, and I am pissed to the heights of passivity. But it's economic human rights that we are talking about. The right that economic institutions meet our needs. What a novel idea. The right to pay and support and prop up credit cards. Like that's, you know, something we asked for. I was in South Africa in 1994 when Nelson Mandela was elected president. And it was a really transformative moment for that country. But on the plane there, I sat next to a black woman who's a banker. And she said that she was going over there because for the first time, many black South Africans were going to be allowed to get mortgages on their homes and, you know, participate in the benefits of an advanced technological society that South Africa is. And I have to honestly say, before I could stop myself, I said, who defined a 30-year mortgage as freedom? Because any of us paying those 30 years of mortgages don't feel very free. Why can't y'all take an opportunity to rethink this out? 10-year mortgages. You know, why does it have to be 30 years of slavery to get a home? Who wrote that rule? And if you got a chance to start all over, why would you do it that way? Yeah, so things that make you go, Anyway, economic human rights. The right to join a trade union. The right to a living wage is an economic human right, not a minimum wage, a living wage. Because the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that you have the right to a life worthy of human dignity, not just the ability to scrape by. The fourth category, Gory, is called social human rights. This is the right to receive those things necessary for your human existence. Think about it. What things, if you didn't have them, would really mess you up for a while? And I'm not talking about the right to watch March Madness, much as I'd like to, even though Georgetown lost real early in the NIT. I'm thinking of food. Without food, you're not going to feel very human very long. Water, health care. The most interesting social human right is the human right to an education. It is a person's fundamental human right to receive an education. I think therein lies the explanation for why our educational institutions aren't so eager to teach us that education is a human right. because then we may start questioning why we're paying $50,000 to $60,000 for something that should be free. And the whole financial structure of what we call education just might collapse a little bit. So I think, I mean, you don't have to be Mel Gibson to believe in the conspiracy theory to know that there probably is some illogic in schools of education teaching us what our human rights are. Because it would be a self-defeating kind of thing to know that education is a human right. What I also like about social human rights is that it takes that whole equality difference argument that we have as feminists and twists it all up and throws it away. Are y'all familiar with what I'm talking about, the equality difference paralysis? For those of you who don't know, most of y'all are probably not privileged enough to be in women and gender studies. The way it goes is women have not been able to figure out how to get equality. That's the bottom line. Some of us think in order to be treated equal to men, we have to be like men. We have to be treated, you know, just ignore all the differences that make us women and act just like men in order to be treated like men. And I'm not talking about butch femme. I'm talking about, which is a whole nother discussion. I'm just talking about minimizing or sublimating the biological differences and acting like they don't matter because we're all just human beings. That's the equality feminist. The difference feminists say, wait a moment, the plumbing does matter. And matter of fact, it matters to such an extent that it's the source of most of our oppression, our ability to have children. How can you ignore that when that's the reason that we get paid less than men, we're kicked out of the workforce quicker? You know, the whole patriarchal system is built on our plumbing. So how can we ignore that in the pursuit of equality? So they want to acknowledge difference, but say difference shouldn't be used as a way or a rationale for discrimination. Y'all got the basic framework? Well, the way that the human rights framework changes all of that is that it's a framework of both equality and difference. Let's say if you agree that every child has a right to an education, right? A human right to an education. That's the equality standard. Everyone has the same human rights, a right to an education. You may also agree that a blind child might need her books in Braille. That's the difference. That's the difference. And so basically what it says is that while we all have the same human rights, based on our individual identities, our markers, our intersections, we all may need something different to get to the same plateau everybody else is at. So that you pay attention to the differences in order to get to the same human rights. It's not special rights, it's special needs to get to human rights. Does that make sense to people? How it just neatly entwines difference and equality together as opposed to seeing them as oppositional. The fifth category of human rights is called cultural human rights. I need to speed this up because I'm tired of standing. I put this chair down here in case I got tired. Cultural human rights are the right to practice the culture of one's choice, to speak the language of your choice, to get services in the language of your choice. By definition, the English-only movement is a human rights-violating movement because people have the right. It is the right to practice. Well, one of the things that young people like when I say this, it's the right to wear the clothes of your choice. Crazy as they may seem. But cultural human rights also contains the freedom to practice the religion of one's choice. And religious freedom is a very strongly held value in the United States. But what most people don't realize is that cultural human rights is also freedom from religion. And that's the right to not have someone else's religious values imposed upon us. And I think if we in the women's movement understood the human rights framework better, we would be arguing that those who are opposed to abortion rights talking about the personhood of the fetus would be human rights violators trying to impose their religious views on the rest of us. And they have no more right to do that than to tell me I have to be Catholic. That's a human rights violation. So those are the five categories that were laid out originally in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And then new social movements came about that demanded new human rights. For example, eventually somebody recognized that we needed environmental human rights. Because without a clean environment, potable water, air that isn't toxic, we may not be around to enjoy the rest of those human rights. And then the seventh category is called developmental human rights. And these are human rights mostly demanded by countries in what we call the developing world. These are the rights they demanded to control their own natural resources. What a novel concept that is. Like, for example, our war against Iraq is in violation of their developmental human rights because we've never explained how our oil got under their sand. I mean, was it just a big geological boo-boo that Bush had to correct some kind of way? But we also got developmental human rights issues right here in this country. I was in West Virginia a couple of weeks ago speaking to a West Virginia women's group, and they were talking about the unbelievable lack of health care. And they were right on the West Virginia-Kentucky border. I didn't even know the state's border, I don't think. And they said that in Kentucky, $100,000 a year is spent on a horse's health care in Kentucky because of the Kentucky Derby. Yet these same Virginia and West Virginia coal miners are dying for lack of health care. And I thought about that and I said, that is a clear example of the lack of developmental human rights right here. The people whose land those minerals are being extracted are not receiving any of the benefits of that. They are being colonized in violation of their developmental human rights. How can a state spend $100,000 a year on a horse and have people dying for lack of health care? I mean, what's up with that? I mean, I'm not against the Kentucky Derby or something, but something is wrong with that state's priorities. And we're not talking about private money being spent on these horses. That's the other thing I want to talk about. You know, there's a lot of public subsidies of breeders and stuff in the state. So the eighth category is called sexual human rights, our favorite category. Because these are the rights mostly demanded by the women's movement beginning in the 70s and the 80s, where we decided that women had the right to decide if and when they married, if and when they had kids, if and when they had sex. We even declared sexual pleasure as a human right. Why do we have to declare that? Because a lot of people didn't believe women had the right to sexual pleasure. It was supposed to be something you just endured to have babies. And then something strange happened because once women started claiming these rights, next thing we knew, the queer rights movement said, oh my God, that sounds good. The right to have fun, the right to have babies, the right to marry. Let's call ourselves a sexual rights movement. And again, I want to warn that they're making pretty much the mistake of the civil rights movement, which is claiming only one or two sets of the rights and not the full array. And so that's the current human rights framework. I have every belief that new rights are going to emerge demanded by new conditions. For example, I think the ninth category of human rights in about 20 years is going to be the right to participate in information technology, IT rights. Right now, you're pretty much not even seen as human if you're not connected to the internet. Pretty soon, it's going to be pretty dramatic. So having said all of that, you can see how we transitioned the reproductive justice framework into a human rights-based framework. Because it answers all those, oh my God, questions. The right to health care, the right to a job, the right to social services like welfare if you need them, the right to Social Security, the right to an education. All of these are human rights issues. And so, using the reproductive justice framework as a new form of critical race theory, we started really looking at the question of intersectionality. And again, this is a concept that women of color have been talking about for a long, long time. I mean, I can't claim any originality around that. I mean, Sojourner Truth asked the fundamental intersectional question, which she said, ain't I a woman? And Shirley Chisholm even updated it, I think, in about 1976 or something, when she was president of NARAL. Shirley Chisholm was the first black woman to run for president, for those of you who don't know. And when she was president of NARAL's board, the National Abortion Rights Action League, actually it was the National Association for Repeal of Abortion Laws back then. Anyway, a reporter asked her, why would a black woman want to be president of an abortion rights organization? And Shirley quipped back, well, I couldn't decide whether I was born black or female first. And I wasn't born black, and the doctor hit me on my butt, and I turned into a woman. That's the perfect definition of intersectionality. It basically means that every human being has multiple identities at the same time. And you have to pay attention to these multiple identities to know how to meet the needs of that human being. I mean, most of you in here are students, but that is not the only identity that you have. Yeah, you have other identities. Some are you from the north, some are you from the south, some are you from urban, some are you rural, some of you are Catholic, some of you are Protestant, it doesn't matter. Some of you are gay, some of you are straight, some of you are rich, some of you are poor, some of you are white, some of you are black, some of you are Asian. It doesn't. All that means is that we all live at intersections. For those of you who have never heard this before, Kimberly Crenshaw illustrated it very, very well. She said, imagine that I'm walking down this street, and this is the race street. And then crossing it is the gender street. And as a black woman, I'm right there in the middle. And a car coming from any direction could wipe my butt out. It could be coming from the race street, the race direction, or the gender direction. By standing at that intersection, I'm vulnerable from both directions. Now, that's a simplistic analysis, but think about it. We all stand at the intersection of multiple identities around age, race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, whether our parents went to college. You know, all of these are identities. And so, reproductive justice applies intersectional theory to reproductive politics, basically to say that the ability of any individual to determine what happens to his or her body is directly related to what's going on in their community. You cannot make a decision about controlling your body outside of the context of whether or not you're in a community that may not have health care or be refused health care if you're queer, or you can't get to the doctor because the doctor's a day and a half away, or you don't have health insurance, or you're an immigrant and you're worried about the immigration authorities raiding you if you try to report to the hospital for prenatal care. I mean, all of these identities. Or if you're under 18 and you need to access Plan B, emergency contraception, till a judge just ruled on that a couple of days, that at least you can go down to 17. You're out of luck if you're 16 and you need the morning after pill. Well, you cannot make an independent decision about your body outside of the context in which you live. So if you're a 16-year-old, you can't make an autonomous decision about whether to use the morning after pill, because you're in a community that is barred from accessing that pill. Do you get the concept of intersectionality and embeddedness? So, we believe that the way to address this is to use reproductive justice as an organizing strategy that pulls together various human rights conversations in defense of women's rights. In other words, those of us concerned about economic justice for women, those of us concerned about ending violence against women, those of us concerned about healthy pregnancies and reduced infant mortality for women, we have to work together. And by working together, we're doing something quite different. We're calling it reproductive justice. And I want to close by saying something that generally gets us in trouble. First of all, about the human rights framework. One thing the opening paragraph of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights said is that all human beings are born equal in rights and dignity. Now, that may sound like a self-evident kind of phrase, except that in 1948, they had the common sense acknowledgement that you had to be born to claim the rights. So every sperm does not get human rights. Just doesn't work that way. I don't care what the opponents to abortion say. You kind of have to be here to claim the rights. Nor can you be a potential here and trump somebody else's rights. So again, let's talk about all of this politics in the context of human rights. So that's the first thing I need to say. But the second thing that I want us to contemplate, which I'm about to lose sight of. Every time I think about that sperm with human rights, I kind of get thrown off. You know, wiggly little sucker talking about, what about my rights? What about my rights? You have the right to exit. That's about the only right I'm going to give you today. I swear, I forgot my last point. I'm trying to fake it like I remember it, but, you know, that bad case of CRS just took over. I guess this will do. I'll pretend it's the original one I was going to say. We tend to see our movement in three different aspects. There's the reproductive health sector of the movement that provides health services. And these are vital health services like Planned Parenthood clinics and what have you. Then there's the reproductive rights sector of the movement that fights for legal protections, like fighting for the legal right to abortion. And then we see the reproductive justice sector as the organizing sector that brings all of these movements together to fight for women's rights. Matter of fact, the way we see it is that we're kind of like the women's rights wing of the human rights movement, but there's an environmental justice wing of the human rights movement. There's a youth wing of the human rights movement. Now I remember what I was going to say. Speaking of the youth wing of the human rights movement, the most controversial thing that you might realize once you become familiar with the human rights framework is that to claim the full panoply of rights, the only thing you have to be that nobody gets to debate on is human. Nobody gets to vote on your humanity. You are. That sounds simple till you recognize that that means that young people have the right to sex and sexuality. Ooh. What does that mean? Instead of just saying no, we might have to turn into just say how. That's a whole different conversation, is it? But young people don't get turn 18 and whoops, they're suddenly human with human rights. That ain't how that works. And so if we use the human rights framework and mean it, we're going to have some real different conversations about reproductive politics in this country. Instead of defining young sexuality as a problem, we're going to have the conversation about how to do it safely, if you choose to do it at all. Instead of talking about teen pregnancy as a problem, we're going to talk about the problems that society has in supporting young parents. Instead of talking about the disabilities being a problem, we're going to talk about the disabling environments that people who are disabled face. So it's a totally different conversation when you use human rights and reproductive justice as your framework. And I think that's why people are so afraid of it and oppose it, because we may actually, once we know our human rights, start demanding them. And that would piss a whole lot of people off. Thank you. Maybe, what, 10 minutes for questions? Or however long y'all want to go. But I'm going to sit down for Q&A because my feet hurt now. And if you have no questions, just get out of here. Okay. Yes, stand up in the back, though. Let's let the people who need to leave go so we don't feel like we're dissing them or something.
Okay.
Thank y'all for coming out, by the way. This was a huge crowd. Great job, organizers, by the way. Let's give the organizers a hand because this was a huge turnout. Okay.
This is actually just a comment, not a question. But I'm Heather Champion. I work in the Career Center. And speaking of human rights, for those of you who don't know, it is still legal in Pennsylvania to be fired for being, well, fired for having a child or having a family, and to not be hired because you're pregnant or have a family. So that's just kind of along the lines of human rights and something that a lot of people are unaware of in our own state.
Mm-hmm. In response to your comment, the United States is the only industrialized country that has not ratified the Women's Human Rights Treaty, known as CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. And the reason we haven't ratified it is that for fear that it will make discriminatory laws like that here in Pennsylvania illegal. And so you get a lot of senators to ratify the treaty. It only takes a 2/3 majority of the Senate, because that makes the treaty ratification equal to the federal government, to federal law, according to Article 6 of the Constitution. So it makes a lot of people who are okay with the status quo of discrimination that we have fail to vote for the ratification of the Women's Human Rights Treaty. And we're going to have to take that up seriously. Obama has sent an indication that he will put CEDAW on his agenda once he finishes the economy and a few other messes that he inherited. Any other questions? Yes. Get your hands up so she knows how to run the mic to you.
I have two questions. Well, both interlocking, but in the book Conquest by Andrea Smith, she dares the reader to imagine a world where anything, imagine a world without the social construction that we live under right now. And Audre Lorde says the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. So where do we start?
Whoa.
Do we dare even imagine?
First of all, you fascinate me because you asked one of the best questions. And I just had lunch with Andy a couple of days ago, and I knew Audrey, so I'm like, how dare those women put me on the spot? But, you know, so let me see. First of all, what Andy points out in Conquest and a number of her other writings, like, you know, the Revolution Will Not Be Funded and other things that she's written, is that we've been so busy building a movement declaring what we're against, we failed to spend adequate time articulating what we would be for. As a matter of fact, if we'd won, whatever winning means, we wouldn't know what the hell to do. You know, and so she challenges us to spend an equal amount of time imagining what a human rights realized world would look like as we are talking about what a human rights violating world looks like. Now, Audrey's question, can the master's tool dismantle the master's house, really asks a profound question, because we are forced to use the master's tools to attempt the dismantling. I mean, there are many of us in education to learn the language of the elites. But in our hearts, we want to use the skills we acquire in these elite institutions to dismantle elitism. And so that's a classic master's tool kind of process. The question isn't the tools, but the heart that wills them, in my mind. Because the master's tools can be used to further elitism or dismantle it. It's not the tool. It's kind of like, you know, it's not the weapon. It's who the thought behind the weapon. The tools are just that. They're tools. The question is, what's the heart wielding the tools say? And so I don't know the answer to Audrey's question. I know that's the Sisyphus kind of thing we're trying to do, which is learn an adequate enough grasp of the tools to use them in service of people's human rights. Now, whether we get sucked in, co-opted, bought out, we don't know yet.
Yeah, my question is that George W. Bush and Laura Bush has claimed that the war on terror in Iraq and Afghanistan is also a fight for women's rights, because under Islam, and especially in Afghanistan, women were brutally suppressed. They were not allowed to go to schools. They were not even allowed to go outside of their houses, in Iraq also. So what is your comment on that?
I felt that the Bush administration, and particularly the architect of it all, Dick Cheney — I don't think George Bush was smart enough to think of that one — used the miserable condition of the women of Afghanistan, and they can't even say the same thing about the women of Iraq. The women of Iraq were some of the most modernized women in the Islamic world, so you can't necessarily say the same thing in some instances. But the women of Afghanistan truly are gender oppressed. But one doesn't end gender oppression by coming in and killing the women you're trying to free. There's something wrong with that formula. I mean, and that's eventually what they did, so it showed how hollow that argument was. It was about oil. It always is about oil. Every war in the world presently is about natural resources. Believe me, the situation in Darfur is because there's oil in the land that the people of Darfur live on, and China wants it. I mean, so it's all about oil and diamonds and gold and all of this other stuff. So that's what you have to believe. As a human rights activist, I believe the best way to help people free themselves, particularly from our posture as people of privilege, is to give resources over to them so that they can conduct their own liberation struggle. And let us not use the misery of their condition to ignore the fact that we got human rights violations taking place in this country that perhaps drawing attention to might make us a little uncomfortable, so we'd rather see people in other countries as barbarians we have to fix. Or even worse, we have to save brown women from brown men in a totally colonizing kind of thing. You know, so if we wanted to address the situation of women in Afghanistan, we do best pouring resources into building the indigenous Afghan women's movement. And there is a revolutionary Afghan Women's Association here in the United States.
If you had a magic wand and you could make any structural change in the West, and specifically in the United States, in order to minimize harm done to human rights and maximize the potential gain, what structural change would you enact?
If I had a magic wand, I think the first thing that I would make illegal is having money influence politics and democracy. Because with that one strategic change, we could change healthcare, we could change education, we could change war, we could change the amount of weapons going across the border to Mexico. I mean, we could change so much if the levers of our democracy weren't controlled by money. Yeah, I think that would be the one strategic initiative I'd do that would change a whole lot of things at the same time. I don't know if that makes any sense, but if I had the magic wand, I'd sever the connection between money and politics. I would make every candidate run on the same amount of money. I would make television stations give away political ads for free as part of their ability to maintain a license from the FCC. You know, their providing political space would be part of their obligation for getting the license in the first place. I mean, I would just get money out of politics.
It would be publicly
supported instead of privately backed. Right. But that's getting money out of politics. It would do that same thing.
We have time for one more question.
One question that I hear often in my classes, but also just among the fantastic students that I work with, is we are so overwhelmed with so many problems, so many forces that really do serve to oppress. And so I hear a lot of students today talking about forces of oppression, but feeling like there's not a solution as to how to fix them or how even to address them. The sense of overwhelm is that great. And so I wonder if you might speak to the sort of potential in this moment right now and harnessing a sense of new social movement that is relevant for young people today.
Don't y'all have dumb questions? First of all, half the battle is recognizing the injustice and understand that you already are ahead of the game if you recognize the injustice, because the vast majority of people experiencing the injustice are not given the privilege of recognizing it. Secondly, even though the thing can seem overwhelming, compare it to the 50-page term paper. You don't get nothing done until you get the first page typed. And you bite it off in what my friend calls chunky pieces. The same way you attack any other mega problem. It's trying to write off 50 pages at once or being afraid of writing that first page, which is where most of us usually end up, right? That just makes the whole task seem so overwhelming. And then you get to like page 47, you're like, oh, hell, I just knocked this out. And so it's about perspective. Part of the reproductive justice framework is that it's presenting all the human rights to you at the same time. So that can be feel overwhelming because you're like, I can't work on everything at the same time. I mean, what if... That's crazy making. Nor will I be effective if I try to do everything at the same time. Again, bite off the chunk that you can chew. Maybe you're talking about reducing infant mortality as a human right. That's what you focus on. Or you may be focusing on ESL, English as Second Language services, as your chunk of it that you focus on. Focus on that chunk and do it as well as you can in service to others, and you will be part of a larger human rights movement. Jesus already got a job, so, I mean, don't enter this movement thinking you're going to take his job and be everything to everybody, because that ain't going to happen. And that's just your ego talking, because you're going to fail, actually. And so, I mean, I said that flippantly, but the reality is that it's not about taking on the whole thing. It's about understanding the whole thing and figuring out what's your win and where you enter point in that matrix. But you're not taking on the entire matrix. Nobody can take on the entire matrix. Collectively, we can take on the entire matrix, but not individually. And so, chunk it up. All right. Thank y'all.
Thank you.